Hi, I'm Dan Webster, film critic for Spokane Public Radio and blogger for Spokane7.com.
And I'm Mary Pat Truthart, part-time film critic, full-time law professor at Gonzaga University School of Law.
And I'm Nathan Weinbinder, also a film critic for Spokane Public Radio and film and music editor for The Inlander.
And welcome to Movies 101, the show that considers the annual Oscars Fest its version of the Super Bowl. That doesn't mean, however, that we watch it with any less of a critical eye than we do the movies we devour the rest of the year. In fact, especially this year, we might even be a tad more critical than usual. We'll discuss our reactions to the 93rd Oscars event, which was televised last Sunday, after we take a look at one of the five films nominated for Best Animated Feature, Ireland's Wolfwalkers, which you can see on a big screen at the Magic Lantern Theater. Though it didn't win the gold statuette, which went predictably to the Disney Pixar feature Soul, Wolfwalkers was a worthy nominee. Co-directed by Tom Moore and Ross Stewart, it is the third entry in a trilogy that began with 2009's The Secret of Kells and 2014's Song of the Sea. Set in 1650 Kilkenny, Ireland, the film tells the story of a young English girl, Robin Goodfellow, voiced by Honor Navesey, whose father, Bill, voiced by Sean Bean, is tasked by the Lord Protector, voiced by Simon McBurney, with cleaning a wolf pack from the neighboring forest. Robin, who wants to be a hunter like her father, breaks with her own sexist classist society's expectations and heads into the forest herself. There she encounters a young wolf walker, a spirit, voiced by Eva Whittaker, who becomes a wolf when she sleeps. The film offers both political and social commentary. The English are an occupying force, remember, and young girls shouldn't be destined only for a future as scullery maids. But the movie explores spirituality too, especially considering the healing powers of nature. What made me most memorable, though, is the color palette that Moore and Stewart use, and which demonstrates, as with the best of its genre, the full visual power of animated film.
Right, and I think we can get into, as you call them, sort of the political overtones of Wolfwalkers, and certainly the gender dynamics of this film, and frankly, all of the features that this Irish studio Cartoon Saloon have produced. Because not only did they do The Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea, as you mentioned, they also did that movie The Breadwinner. And all four of those features have been really thoughtful and surprisingly astute for movies supposedly aimed at family audiences about how young women have to navigate a world that doesn't really have a place for them and how they have to kind of try and fight for that place. And so we can talk more about that. But I agree with you here that the thing that stands out to me about this movie is just the look of it. I absolutely love the hand-drawn animated style of this, which is not really the hip way of making animated movies anymore. I mean, you talk about Pixar and even DreamWorks Animation, they have this really glossy, clean 3D CGI style. And that can look really gorgeous and almost photorealistic in the How to Train Your Dragon movies in particular. I mean, the way that they've rendered, you know, nature in those films is breathtaking. But here, the animation style is, you can see the pencil strokes and you can see how they've actually animated it cell by cell. And I'm sure they use computer technology to make the seams less obvious. But still, you really get the sense that there was a lot of handmade care put into this movie. And there are certain shots that look like a two-page spread in a children's book or something like that. And considering it's set, you know, in the 1600s in Ireland, there's also sort of like a tapestry quality to this, where it's almost like, you know, some kind of wall hanging that's telling a story. We get tableaus like that in this movie. And it's really beautiful. I just love, it's the same reason I love, you know, stop motion animation, that particularly the stuff that Wes Anderson has done, because you can see where the animators have put the work in. You can almost see the fingerprints in the ink. And I really like that about this movie. I do think that in terms of the Oscar race, I saw a lot of people stumping for this movie, saying that, of course, it was going to go to the Pixar movie. Why wouldn't it? It should go to Wolfwalkers. I don't love it quite as much as a lot of people do. I mainly thought this was too long. It's about 100 minutes, and I think it kind of stretches out for maybe 15 or 20 minutes too long. But I don't know. I thought this was good, and I also like the fact that all three of these movies in this so-called trilogy that includes Secret of Kells and Song of the Sea, I like that they're they're not easy G-rated kids movies. They're tough and they're scary. There's genuine peril in these movies. And those are the kinds of films that I gravitated to when I was a kid. You know, I didn't like being pandered to that movies that said, you know, the world is just great all the time. I like the fact that these movies...
last statement does not surprise us.
Yeah, I know. Right. Yes, I was a childhood sadist, but I don't know. I like movies that are about kids and are geared towards a younger audience or a family audience, and that still kind of have some edge to them, that have teeth and menace. And this movie has that. And so I appreciated the fact that it was tough about its subject matter, yeah, and didn't sand off the edges.
Yeah, it follows in the tradition of Maurice Sendak, you know? I mean, there are monsters, sure, in the woods.
Nathan, you were talking about how beautiful it is. And that has to be the first thing that people will notice about this, because even if you didn't follow the story at all, I think folks would be mesmerized by what they're seeing in front of them. And it is...
Especially if you watch it at the Magic Lantern.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, we have a relatively large TV and we saw it there, and I would like to see it again at the Magic Lantern or on a bigger screen. Nathan, you brought up some of the themes of the film. And of course, we have the fierce daughter who wants to follow in her father's footsteps. And so that's part of what's going on, this sort of father-daughter relationship. But the larger milieu in which we find ourselves, you know, brings up that tension of the clash between the Irish people and the British coming in, because the Lord Protector,
in particular, yes, the English.
Yes, because the Lord Protector is clearly in that mold. At first, we want to chastise the girl for her naivete. At the same time, we admire her willingness to venture into the woods when no one else seems willing to do so. But then we start to realize these people are living in fear. This totalitarian regime that's been imposed on them has turned all of the villagers into frightened individuals, and something needed to happen for them to break free from that. So I thought that was handled effectively, and maybe younger children could watch this on one level and appreciate what's going on without maybe understanding all the nuances of it. And I always like animated films that, you know, are sort of multi-layered, either in terms of their humor or their subject matters. So Wolfwalkers is one of those films that could appeal to different people for different reasons.
Yeah, there's a lot more going on in this film than an easy recitation of the plot line would indicate. Part of the what you've both referred to is the notion that the English here set up things so that the fear of them is transferred to the monsters, to the wolves in the forest, which is a classic way of people throughout history of dominating a certain group of people. But that said, you don't even have to go there, because on the top of it, what you were talking about, Nathan, one of the things that I really liked about the movie Wolfwalkers, besides the color palette, which is just amazing, is the throwback representation to animations of the past. And there is no more better example of the contrast there than the ultimate Pixar Disney winner, Soul, which is hyper-realistic, and this, which is more representational than realistic. It was just a joy to watch. And I agree, maybe a little bit long, and maybe ultimately not quite as complete a statement in any way as, say, Soul, for example, which I thought was a worthy winner.
I think if you're going to have any films geared toward children, shorter is probably better. Or mm-hmm. even for those of us who in our adult lives have a little problem sitting still for long periods of time. So yes, I agree that would have been helpful. We haven't really talked about the voices, and mm-hmm. I'm always fascinated by the people who show up, some of whom we know, some of whom we don't know. But I thought that the animators did a really effective job of choosing the right people.
Oh, yeah. Honor to Nafcy and Eva Whitaker. They were just both perfect as the little girls.
Agreed. And obviously, it's always good to hear Sean Bean in anything.
Yes. And Simon McBurney, let's not forget him, the evil Lord Protector.
And we've talked about, you know, the father-daughter dynamic here. And certainly there are shades of Brave, speaking of Pixar, there's right. a lot, you know, of overlap there in the themes of I want to be a warrior, but I'm a girl. What am I supposed to do? There's also, I think the central relationship of this movie we haven't even brought up is the friendship between the two girls right. who both mm-hmm. feel like outsiders and don't really understand why, and the kinship that they find. But there's also kind of that tension there because, you know, she's a hunter and she's a wolf walker. I think that's what really brings the movie together. And I think it's a really sweet central friendship there.
But no one had to be a scullery maid for any period of time. So that was a plus.
Correct. Yes.
And that was our discussion of the animated film Wolf Walkers. This is Movies 101. It's time to take a short break. Before we go, remember that you can access podcasts and Movies 101 by going online at SpokanePublicRadio.org. While there, check out the individual reviews that Nathan and I write. Don't do it now, though, because we'll be right back to look at the 93rd Oscars celebration. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
For more than 40 years, Spokane Public Radio has been bringing news, information, arts, and entertainment to the Inland Northwest, funded largely by listener contributions.
You listen! You listen!
But now, due to a worldwide pandemic, we have been unable to present the on-air pledge drives that are vital to our fundraising efforts.
Contagion! Contagion!
Undaunted, fearless, and dedicated listeners from all over the Inland Northwest have stepped forward and made their contributions to keep Spokane Public Radio and its programs on the air.
Donation! Donation!
It is only with your help that we can continue bringing this important public service to the region.
Connection! Connection!
We are grateful that you have chosen to keep our connection.
Appreciation!
Thank you.
And we're back. This is Movies 101, and I'm your host, Dan Webster. During the first half of the show, Mary Pat Truthart, Nathan Weinbinder, and I discussed the Oscar-nominated animated feature, Wolfwalkers. Let's now move to Hollywood's annual orgy of self-congratulation, the 93rd Oscars broadcast. If you watched the show, as the three of us did, you may have noticed that things were done differently this year. That's understandable, considering that the Motion Picture Academy itself is gradually evolving, thanks to the addition of more women and members of color. Still, some of the decisions made by the show's producers were baffling, including the curious lack of movie clips to document this, the most visual of all media, a memoriam sequence that at times went by so fast it was nigh impossible to process the names and faces, and a switch in the traditional order of award presentations that led to a climactic moment that ended up having all the dramatic effect of a cold plate of pasta. The effect was a show that felt insular, metaphorically patting itself on the back while giving us, the general audience, little reason to understand why we should care.
I'm going back and reading my texts that we exchanged among the three of us on Sunday about this particular show.
While the show was going on,
right,
yes.
While the show was going on. And number one, first of all, I, for some reason, didn't appreciate fully that the musical numbers were going to be screened in advance because, you know, sometimes they're corny and sometimes they're not particularly well done or they're way over the top, but I always look forward to those musical numbers. So that was my first mistake, not appreciating fully when things would start. And I figured there wouldn't be the usual red carpet approach because there were so few people attending. But at some point, if we're going to talk about attire, I think the male nominees get a particular shout out this year for some inventive attire and so forth. But so the program kicks off, and I appreciate that Soderbergh, who was
Steven Soderbergh, the director,
yes, was trying to do something different in this COVID pandemic year and so forth. But in my opinion, this entire program missed the mark. So I'm just going to start out from that perspective. So it was shot as though it were a film. Great.
Supposedly.
Yeah, we have Regina King, who's going to be the presenter or the initial presenter because there was really no host. So those of you who have lamented choices of the past, such as Rob Lowe and Snow White and James Franco and Anne Hathaway, probably were pleased by the fact that there was no specific host. But Regina King acquitted herself well. She almost tripped going up to her opportunity to kick things off, a la Jennifer Lawrence a few years ago. But from that point on, I mean, really from about minute three, I think I started texting, what's going on here? You know, this is, as Dan pointed out, one of the more solipsistic sort of gatherings that we've seen. And that's not what we as the audience wanted and needed in this particular year. Yes, I am totally fine with people talking about politics and integrating that into what they're doing and what they have to say. But it was too geared toward the heavy. And as Dan pointed out, when you could walk away from watching this entire show and not understand or know what any of the movies happens to be about, I think that's super problematic from the get-go. And then they decided to do this sort of strange introduction to some of the nominees, you know, so they would say, Dan Webster worked at McDonald's on his way up, and Mary Pat Truthart was a cocktail waitress, you know, at the Philadelphia Sheraton, and Nathan swept floors at the Magic Lantern Theater. And I'm like, great. Is this to tell us that these stars, oh, they're more like one of us? Or what was the point of that? I don't know. And then my big problem is, get up there, have three people that you're going to thank, get your award and get off, because these speeches were interminable. And yeah, of course, if you ramble on for 10 minutes, there are probably going to be some flashes of brilliance in there. But for the most part, this was a major, major snooze fest and a huge miss at a time when only 15% of people surveyed, for example, by MSN, said they intended to watch the Oscars anyway. So 85% weren't planning to tune in. I'm sure of the 15% who did tune in, about 10% of them probably bailed like within the first half hour. So I'm just really sad because the Oscars are like a high holy day in our family. And that did not happen this year in any way.
Well, you know, when the Oscars started out, they were basically a private party in a banquet hall somewhere. And they were mostly designed by the studio system to placate the actors and keep them happy under their contracts. That was,
and that's what this felt like. Yeah.
That's exactly what this felt like. It felt like an insider kind of party that we just happened to be privy to. The big thing for me was, well, first of all, you know, Steven Soderbergh obviously is the big name that everyone recognizes as a main producer of this. And the opening shot of Regina King coming into Union Station where this was filmed had a very like Ocean's 11 kind of feel to it. And it felt like a new, like, oh, we haven't seen the Oscars do this before. I really liked that flourish. Yeah. But then you got into all of the nominees and the acting nominees in particular, and we didn't get any clips of them performing. Instead, we got Laura Dern talking about how much she liked Daniel Kaluuya. And it's like, you know, I appreciate that, but also, especially in a year where it's pretty clear based on the viewer numbers, as you said, not many people watch this. I don't think a lot of people saw the nominated movies for the most part. And so they're going to be watching this going, well, okay, so Yoo Jung-yoon won for Minari. Why don't we get a clip of her performance so that people that haven't seen that movie understand what she's doing in that movie and why she totally deservedly won.
And why so that they would bizarre want to choice. Watch it.
Yeah, that it was such a bizarre choice to me. And as the ceremony went on, we got more clips from the nominated movies, but it was almost too little too late. And so that was an odd choice. And I mean, every year now, the Oscars are kind of a lose-lose proposition, because every year I've already been reading takes saying this was actually one of the better Oscar ceremonies, and other takes saying this is the worst Oscar ceremony I've ever seen. Yeah. And that happens every year. I just feel like you can't please everybody. This one, at least, I kind of admired the chances they took, and we can talk about the biggest swing and a miss that they had, which everyone is talking about, the very last award that was called out, which normally goes to Best Picture. Right. They rearranged it so that it ended with Best Actress and then Best Actor, clearly assuming, like we all did, that Chadwick Boseman was going to win for Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. Instead, it went to Anthony Hopkins, who wasn't there because he, you know, he's in his 80s and he lives in Wales. He's not going to fly to the, you know, to LA. Because they had hubs around the world. But yeah, so they took some swings. Most of them didn't pay off, but I mean, at least it was different, I guess. I think I liked it more than you guys, but not that much more.
No, I mean, there were some high moments, you know, but they were few and far between. Harrison Ford's reading of the notes concerning Blade Runner. I mean, that was nice. Self-deprecation and criticism, that was good. Yoo Jung-yoon's acceptance speech was just terrific when she turns to Brad Pitt. Hey, how come you didn't come to the shooting? That was wonderful. Right, exactly. And I liked Tyler Perry's speech when he got the Gene Herschelt Award. I thought the whole notion of refusing to hate was really nice. And with you, I did like Regina King walking into Union Station. But I've already gotten into arguments, or I refuse to argue, with people who say, you know, Chadwick Boseman should have won. Chadwick Boseman was terrific in that film. Anthony Hopkins's performance was the performance of his career. It is one of the best performances I've ever seen in any movie anywhere. He was well worthy. It's not like Brokeback Mountain and Crash or many of the other so-called snubs over the years. Chadwick Boseman was great, but let's face it, you know.
Well, and they kept calling it an upset loss, and that was an inaccurate characterization for anyone. Well,
yeah, they both would have been deserving winners, right?
Exactly. Like
if Boseman would have won, it would have been deserving.
And you know, I think that Chadwick Boseman, we know him in so many different incarnations, but he chose to keep his battle with cancer private. So I'm not sure that he would have wanted any sort of pity or vote for something such as this. And so maybe things worked out as they should, even though the Academy miscalculated in some way, because it just ended abruptly. And it was like, what? Over.
Thank you, Joaquin Phoenix.
Right.
In fact, I think those were our tech. The last thing I'll say is I think the text that the thread that we had, I think it did. We texted what? Huh?
Yeah. Well, at any rate, that was our take on the 93rd Oscars broadcast. This is Movies 101. I'm Dan Webster. And early in the show, Nathan Weinbinder, Mary Pat Truthart, and I discussed the animated feature Wolfwalkers. Thank you, Pete Glarberg, for both producing and engineering the show. And thank you to our loyal listeners. We invite you back next week, same time, same spot on the radio dial, when we'll again check out all the best that cinema has to offer, wherever we can find it. Until then, reflect on these words from film critic Sean Burns regarding Best Picture winner Nomadland. It's a gentle, uplifting movie about the pioneer spirit in which poor people living in states of terrifying precarity smile crinkly smiles for the camera and beautifully accept their lots in life. Chloe Zhao has made the grapes of wrath without the wrath. You're listening to Movies 101 on Spokane Public Radio.
The Movies 101 podcast is made possible by the members of Spokane Public Radio. Become a member at SpokanePublicRadio.org. Thanks for listening to Movies 101.